Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Your questions can be sent to us via radio program at AOL.com. That's the destination for questions every week. And we gather up the questions in our mailbag and we answer them to the best of our ability. So, Layla, what's next?
We have an email from Michael. Hi, folks. I want to thank both of you for the informative podcasts. I listen to them regularly. Thank you, Michael. I'm 73 years old, and I've been blind since birth with congenital glaucoma. I'm diabetic. My last A1C was 5.8, and I lowered it.
That's pretty good.
I lowered it from a 6.6.
Awesome.
That is fabulous, Michael. I find that if I don't eat before my morning workouts, I don't feel as strong, and I feel a little weak. After my workout, sometimes I feel frustrated and even a little irritable.
That could be a low blood sugar thing.
Yeah. For example, when I reach for things, they seem to be a few inches off.
That could be a real sign of a low blood sugar.
Yeah. I drink lots of liquids while I'm working out. Am I working out too hard? Am I not hydrating enough? Are these unusual symptoms? Could be low blood sugar.
Could be low blood sugar. Yeah, I mean, this is a little...
We don't know if he's on diabetic medication or anything, but he's lowered his A1C to 5.8, which is terrific.
Right. I mean, certainly if you're taking something, a diabetic medication, there might be more of a reason to eat something before you work out because, you know, you need to protect yourself from low blood sugar.
Right, you need to feed
which
the
medicine cause you to
a little
feel
bit
sort
before,
of irritable.
Because the exercise is like taking a pill.
Yeah. It'll be right. You'll feel when your blood sugar is low, you'll feel irritable, you'll feel lack of coordination, you sort of hit the wall.
Yeah.
Mentally, too, you know.
Right. Right.
So we don't know exactly what's going on with this guy.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be interesting to do a little experiment with either finger sticks or a continuous glucose monitor. It's a little harder when you're blind because, I mean, you can get these devices to talk to you sometimes, but to check your blood sugar. You know, before, during and after exercise, maybe, and see if we can correlate blood sugars with the symptoms he's experiencing.
Yeah.
So that we can see if eating something is going to alleviate that.
Yeah. Yeah. And Michael, do what's best for your workout. If you're somebody who requires some kind of a little snack, a very light breakfast, and then maybe you'll do your workout an hour, hour and a half later, maybe that will suit you just fine.
Well, you know, I have to say that
would feel more effective during the workout.
Generally is that people who are inexperienced exercisers or people with blood sugar problems, they generally do require something before they exercise.
Right. We know people, diabetics who take insulin, they have to monitor that very carefully. So, but we don't know that about Michael, so I'm assuming...
Right. If you take insulin, you should eat a little something before you exercise.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. You know, but experienced exercisers, and this is something I've tried to acquire over the years, is we can go longer and longer and longer without eating anything. And that's actually favorable for fat burning, and it's also favorable for blood sugar control, but it's sort of something you have to acclimate to. You create more glycogen stores, or the capacity to store glycogen. And then you don't exhaust your glycogen depots in your liver and in your muscles. Also, the bigger muscles you have, the more glycogen storage capabilities you have.
Yes.
So if you have like eensy-weensy weak muscles, you don't have as much glycogen storage.
Yeah.
So muscle is sort of a buffer against high and low blood sugar. So I find that, you know, through habit and through a pattern of exercising where I go for... you know, an hour or two, up to an hour or two without eating, and eat late, you know, and have...
You're not famished by then? Because, you know, the window is really 60 minutes after exercise to get ample protein to repair the muscles.
Yeah, my body sometimes talks to me like, you know, exercise actually kind of decreases my appetite.
After, you're not hungry at all. For example, you could be hungry before you start exercising in the morning,
and then it dissipates.
And then it goes away.
Yeah.
But then sometime around an hour or so, it's like, wow, I'm getting
just
hungry.
Just ravenously hungry. Yeah.
It's like it catches up.
And sometimes, I mean, if it's like a really long thing, I'll almost feel hunger beyond the capacity of my stomach to handle it. It'll be like my stomach.
You can't get enough food on your fork.
Right.
Kind of. Yeah. That's really low blood sugar right there.
Yeah.
I think with exercise and the adrenaline that's released, the epinephrine, that that suppresses appetite because
it brings blood sugar up. It brings blood sugar up.
Mother Nature also thinks you have to get busy running away from a predator if you're on a run or something.
Right.
There's no time to be hungry right now.
Right.
It's inappropriate.
Right.
So that could be the mechanism.
And that's a little bit, you know, it's a starvation state, but I think it's nice. I think humans have the rare opportunity to starve. And I think starving is a paleo kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, while it
fasting from time to time,
it may be unpleasant, cultivating.
Only in the beginning.
Yeah.
After, you know, you get to a point, and everybody's experienced this, where you're going through your day, it's lunchtime, you're noticing hunger, then you're ravenously hungry, and suddenly it all stops. You're no longer hungry.
Yeah, that happens.
That's the gift.
That sometimes happens on days where I really try to make a point of having a meal in the middle of the day, because as a public service to people that are around me and my patients, so that I'm in a good mood and I'm, you know, mentally resourceful and I'm not hangry.
You're not hangry.
Right.
And you can put a sentence together.
But sometimes I say, look, you know, I've got an early afternoon. I can just plow right through and then I can eat.
You're
right. The hunger passes.
It does pass. It does pass. And it's like, oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Michael, thank you for that question. All right. Oh, this comes from Kay. Having been misdiagnosed and undiagnosed for 6 years, my daughter continues to suffer from symptoms of congestive heart failure.
Wow. And this is a relatively young person.
Yeah.
You know.
Not trusting the local providers available to us, we don't know how to handle her later stages now of congestive heart failure. What can we do to help her? What should she be doing?
There's not a lot of data here on what is causing it. And, you know, there's obviously some frustration with the medical system here, but I can't imagine that they have not the foggiest idea why this person at a young age is developing congestive heart failure.
Yeah.
Because normally older people develop congestive heart failure due to frequent heart attacks, you know, part of the heart muscle is knocked out, you know, and or, you know, aging heart or valvular abnormality that's causing the heart to become baggy and weak, you know, that's the typical congestive heart failure. So when younger people get congestive heart failure, it may be due to a virus. You know, like a viral cardiomyopathy or an autoimmune
car. That could happen to anybody.
Some sort of autoimmune, you know, like lupus related or blah, 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 something like that. So, you know, we would want to look at cause, but let's presume that she just has heart failure, congestive heart failure, and what could we do naturally? I just did a fascinating interview with one of the pioneers in coenzyme Q10 and ubiquinol research, who's Dr. Peter Langen. Mm. And he actually collaborated with his father, who first used clinically coenzyme Q10 when it first was available. And that started to happen in the 80s.
Yes.
And, you know, it was discovered. They didn't really recognize its clinical applications. It was the Langens, father and son, who began using it and popularizing it in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
So that by the time you started nutritional practice, it really was in favor.
Yeah.
So he has a lot of experience in treating, he's a cardiologist, so he has a lot of experience in treating CHF, congestive heart failure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things about congestive heart failure is that we don't really have any drugs that really are that effective for congestive heart failure. And that's a problem because more and more people developing congestive heart failure. And it's the Langen's theory that part of the reason for that is statins.
Yes.
Statins interfere with CoQ10 synthesis and can actually He's written papers where he's taken patients who are on statins, taken them off the statins, and they do better, and he gives them CoQ10, and he alleviates their congestive heart failure.
And as a matter of course, Dr. Hoppen, anybody who comes in and they're already taking a statin, we're always making sure that they're taking some amount of CoQ10 or ubiquinol.
Right. So the key insights I got from him, and you really should listen to the podcast because it's fascinating. It's like really talking to the guru of coenzyme Q10 and ubiquinol, and he really understands it, is that you can use CoQ10, but for patients who are very sick, they don't have the ability to absorb it. Mm-hmm. So they need to use ubiquinol, which is preferentially absorbed. It's more potent by a factor of, you know, 1.5 to 2 times as effective.
Yeah.
More expensive, but it's necessary in people who really are in bad shape. And so the doses he was using, like 600 to 900 of ubiquinol.
Yeah.
Because for congestive heart, not just for you and I for prevention, but for the people who have real heart failure.
Now, I've heard Dr. Steven Sinatra say, integrative cardiologist, that congestive heart failure is a lack of energy in the heart. Mm-hmm. And that is the essence of coenzyme Q10.
You're right, right. Yeah. Now, I also asked Peter Langen if he thought that the companion, I said, you know, you're obviously familiar with Dr. Sinatra's protocol, which is to use carnitine and ribose and magnesium. And he says he thinks those things are helpful, but he doesn't think that they're on a par with CoQ10 in terms of their efficacy for congestive heart failure. But the four things that we would use for CHF would be high-dose ubiquinol. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the problem is people may not be seeing results when they take like 100 or 200. You really got to go to heroic doses, which can be kind of expensive.
Yeah.
The other insight he gave me is he said that when you're using ubiquinol, it's more bioavailable if you take it with a fatty meal and if you break the capsule, because it comes in rather thick capsules, because it actually
like a soft gel.
Yeah, it's susceptible to degradation by light and heat.
Okay.
So it's in these rather thick capsules. He says, bite down on the capsule and extract the ubiquinol for greater bioavailability. He thinks it's about 20% more bioavailable. So now what I've done is I've put the ubiquinol on my table so that when I'm eating, I just bite down on one capsule, and suck out the contents, and, then with a fatty meal. Most meals that I eat have some fat, so it's not a problem.
Some inherent fat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Layla, what's next?
Oh, we have another question from a different Daniel. I'm a type 2 diabetic. Can I do a keto diet? Well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In one word, absolutely, you should be on a ketogenic diet, a.k.a. low-carb
and
diet.
And more and more studies are coming out validating the very low-carb or ketogenic diet as a remarkable strategy for reversing type 2 diabetes.
Let's be very, very clear and talk about what type 2 diabetes is.
Just for background, you come from your original training, first job in nutrition was working for the late, great Dr. Robert Atkins, who gave people keto sticks.
Yes. Keto sticks, see if it turns purple or not.
Right.
The definition of type 2 diabetes is a condition of carbohydrate intolerance. The antidote is a low-carb diet. It is that simple. It is that simple, and you can completely reverse the trend. So yes, Daniel, you should be on a ketogenic diet if you have type 2 diabetes.
And if it's good even if you have type 1 diabetes, but unless you're making virtually it's good for type
2. It is.
Yeah. It was the former strategy before they came up with insulin.
Exactly.
That's how they kept the kids alive for longer.
Right.
Even though they're making, you can survive without your pancreas making insulin, but it's really tough and eventually your life will be shortened.
That's true.
But you can extend survival. That was the sole therapeutic strategy before the advent of insulin.
Right. Now, there is another trend happening with younger and younger doctors graduating medical school. More and more of them are using insulin as a first drug for type 2 diabetes instead of something like a metformin.
And the idea is that it will spare the pancreas. The pancreas has got to overwork and it will...
Well, here's what else will spare the pancreas, a ketogenic diet.
Thank you.
When you don't eat all those carbs, there's no reason for your pancreas to spew more insulin. You're basically getting Dr. Atkins used to say you're giving your pancreas a rest. You're giving it a break.
Yeah.
And it can repair and rejuvenate all of that.
Yeah. Because think of all the stress you're putting in your pancreas when it's making, 3 to 5 times more insulin than it was intended to make. Eventually, it will burn out.
Exactly. And all that insulin, if you're having to administer insulin, and more doctors are now recommending insulin, which is a very troublesome trend, that insulin is also the starter or partner of inflammation.
It's atherogenic.
It's atherogenic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Insulin is also, high levels of insulin are also intimately associated with cancer. We've known this since the 1980s.
Okay.
I've actually reported on that in my grad school, in my grad thesis.
You were very prescient. That
so
was right. Yeah.
It was very, you have to be careful with insulin. We've had type 1 diabetics go on a low-carb diet, and they were able to reduce their insulin intake. I remember one of them losing 50 pounds.
You know,
and he was at least 50 pounds
per year.
Yeah,
you know, insulin potentiates the adverse effects of estrogen on breast tissue. So that's, they're sort of co-conspirators in breast cancer.
Inflammation is also causing the body to retain more sodium and contributing to high blood pressure.
Right.
Much more than sodium in your diet. So sodium is really the middleman.
Well, it's the
insulin.
It's that bad white stuff in your diet. It's not sodium. It's sugar.
Right, right. It's sugar, exactly. So, and it causes LDL to be small, dense, more atherogenic.
So suffice it to say, the answer is yes.
Yes, go on a keto diet,
for
Daniel.
Type 2 diabetes. Well, you know, I'm just, you know, from where we stand, the answer is obvious, but it, I guess it really speaks to the lack of a knowledge gap.
Yeah.
That a person would say, well, you know, I have type 2 diabetes. Do you think this might help? Is it okay?
Right. And but this, you know, runs in my family.
Yeah. Well,
no, don't throw up your hands and say it runs in your family.
Yeah. But it just, you know, people are saying, well, oh, keto, you know, that's kind of out there. And, you know, the U.S. News and World Report, I think, for the last couple of years running, they list the, you know, best diets. I think a number 49 is the paleo diet.
Right.
And number 50, the worst possible diet is the keto
ketogenic diet.
Right. It's like, how misinformed are they?
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the best diet is the DASH diet, which is lots of, you know, brown rice and, you know,
and whole grains and low fat.
You know, potatoes, skip the butter and sour cream. And,
right.
You know,
that could bring you to diabetes eventually. Right. Unless your former diet was a donut and flan, you know, donut sandwich and bucket of flan diet. That's the only time a DASH diet will do you better.
Oh, flan's bad for you? I like flan.
A bucket of it.
A bucket of it.
And a donut sandwich. Yeah.
It comes in like a little dish at a restaurant. It's so rich.
It's so rich, yeah. That custard. Oh, my gosh. So, thank you, Daniel, for that question.
I like when they come with the flambé on the flan. You ever see that? They ignite the flan. They put a little, like, blue flame on the flan.
A little theater at your table.
It's a little rum, right? It's like, high alcohol content.
Right.
I think we have time for, like, a quick question.
A quick one. Okay. Dr. Hoffman, I'm wondering if the following nutrients and herbs found in a particular supplement, which I'd like to recommend to my brother-in-law because it's anti-inflammatory, might have interaction. Any warnings about the use of these following micronutrients and herbs? Bromelain, turmeric.
Oh, it's in a formula?
It's in a formula.
Okay.
Papain.
Well, this sounds like a formula for the joints, like
it does. Boswellian.
Okay.
Vitamin E, ginger, rutin, glutathione.
Okay. Oh, wow. Yeah.
And devil's claw.
Yeah, all right.
And Mojave yucca root, which I've not found anything in my herbal book about. But the devil's claw will have an interaction with any blood thinning medication.
Right.
And with high blood pressure medications. And it's not to be taken if you have gastric ulcers.
Now,
or duodenal ulcers.
Is this some like secret knowledge that you possess, or is this in the public domain?
It's in the public domain.
Okay.
Yeah, you go look at your PDR.
Okay.
And herbal PDR.
Uh-huh.
And there it is.
But are there also directories of like drug-nutrient interactions and drug-herbal interactions?
Right.
Okay.
There's that. There's there. There's drugs.com.
Okay.
Is another place to go.
Which and lists the herb, by the herb you can see which...
By the herb and so forth. You can go to Dr. Leo Gallen's Pill Advised.
Pill Advised, okay.
Pill Advised is another good source. But there are lots of good resources out there to look for interactions like that. This
ABC, American Botanical Council.
Yeah.
They have pretty good ratings on the herbs and what the contraindications might be for them.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. These would be the places to go.
Now, so this person said, is there any possible reaction with any medication?
Well, does any of the following need a warning about its use or its dosage?
Well, yeah.
All of these things should be taken under some supervision, Albert. And, you know, unless you yourself are a practitioner.
Especially if you have a complicated medical condition,
exactly.
Or if you're on medications.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because what some of these things can do, in addition to thinning your blood or interfering with blood thinners.
Or interfering with blood pressure meds.
Or accelerating the metabolism of certain drugs or slowing the metabolism of certain drugs.
Like grapefruit.
The grapefruit effect. Right.
Yes.
The opposite is the St. John's wort effect,
that interferes with so many things, yeah. I don't even like to recommend it,
yeah.
St. John's wort.
Well, it's best for people who are on no meds,
yes.
Who have depression.
Right.
Then it can work.
You know what I'm afraid of?
What?
That they'll one day be on meds and continue taking St. John's wort, and they didn't share that with their doctor,
It's a pity, because St. John's wort is a valuable thing. It's just gotten such a bad name because it so messes up other medications.
Mm.
But if you're not on any medications and you want a simple, like you're a young person with depression and you want to just try St. John's wort, the only thing I would say, you know, about St. John's wort is be careful when you're in, you know, the sun, because there are some solar interactions you can get, like
photosensitivity
of your skin. Yeah.
All right.
Anyway, so, you know, look, I mean, that question, I think, is a generic question, opens up a generic question about, you know, how do you know if the herbs you're taking are safe? And you can look that up.
Mm-hmm.
Or work with a professional. That's what we do.
That's what we do. Thank you for your question, Albert.
Thank you for your questions in general. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the destination for questions. You can always call us during our radio program. It's a live broadcast Saturdays from noon to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And the number is 877-726-8255. And by the way, that number is set up so that if you want to record a question, you can do so. So several ways you can get questions to us. You can also click on our website at drhoffman.com. Usually a prompt will come up to record a question. So many conduits for questions that we will be happy to field for you. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Until next week, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thank you, Layla.
Thanks.
This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients regularly, along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.